KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A bill to avert a government shutdown heads to the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate after passing the House. How are Democrats weighing up the bill? We asked Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. As President Trump wages a trade war with China, India is sensing an opportunity. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Can it boost its manufacturing industry while avoiding serious tariffs of its own? Also, why a group of faith leaders are holding a vigil on Capitol Hill today and every Wednesday this month. It is Wednesday, March 12th. On this day in 1912, Juliet Gordon Lowe in Savannah, Georgia, started the first Girl Guides troop in the U.S. It would eventually become the Girl Scouts. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Foreign governments are retaliating against President Trump's new 25% tariffs on imports of aluminum and steel. The European Union says it'll put levies on $28 billion of U.S. goods starting April 1st. Canada is putting tariffs on $21 billion of American imports. Dominic LeBlanc is Canada's Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs.
This shouldn't surprise anyone. We have been clear that if the Americans took this unreasonable and unjustified step, Canada would respond as Canadians expect their government to respond.
President Trump has offered a variety of shifting explanations for the tariffs. Some of them include restoring U.S. manufacturing jobs, cutting the flow of fentanyl into the U.S., and stopping illegal immigration. Canadian officials say those issues are not significant problems at the U.S.-Canadian border. The White House is requiring science agencies to send them plans for major cuts to their workforces by tomorrow. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, Democrats overseeing those agencies are asking for those plans, too.
Democrats on the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology sent letters to five science agencies asking for their reduction in force plans as soon as they're sent to the White House. Quote, we are extremely concerned that the so-called Department of Government Efficiency will seek to slash and burn core functions, unquote, of agencies, including the National Science Foundation and NASA. They want to evaluate how the proposed cuts could impair agencies' congressionally mandated missions. Mass firings of probationary employees have already disrupted core government work, including around nuclear safety and monitoring bird flu. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
President Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, is in Qatar. He is trying to negotiate a new ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. The United States is also mediating new talks between Israel and Lebanon. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
An official familiar with the talks and not authorized to speak publicly tells NPR there are efforts to negotiate the release of more than half of the remaining hostages in Gaza, but that there isn't significant progress yet. Israel believes 24 hostages are still alive in Gaza and held by Palestinian militants. In Lebanon Tuesday, Israeli and Lebanese officials held talks mediated by the U.S. and France. They're trying to resolve long-time border disputes, and they discussed the five areas in southern Lebanon where Israeli troops remain despite a recent truce agreement. Israel agreed to release five Lebanese detainees as a gesture to Lebanon's new president with hopes he will rein in the Hezbollah militia. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 340 points. You're listening to NPR News. The House has passed a government spending bill, mostly with Republican votes. It would fund the federal government through the end of the fiscal year in September. The bill now goes to the Senate. Republicans have the majority there, but they need Democratic votes to overcome any potential filibuster. There's also a deadline. If Congress doesn't pass a spending bill, the federal government will partially shut down late Friday night. As cancer rates spike among adults younger than 50, more parents are navigating the disease while parenting. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
One in five adults diagnosed with cancer today is also a parent or guardian of minor children, and that can compound the practical and financial difficulties for patients. Carissa Hodgson is a social worker and program director at Bright Spot Network, a support group for parents with cancer. Her own father died of cancer when she was 7. She says honesty is critical for kids.
It actually helps a child to accept what's going on and work through those big feelings, because it's the fear and the unknown and feeling like you're being kept from the truth. That's what really revs up a child's fear.
Hodgson also encourages finding support through online and in-person communities. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
British officials say they've arrested the captain of a cargo ship on suspicion of manslaughter. His vessel collided with an oil tanker this week off Britain's east coast. Both ships caught fire. The tanker is leaking oil. One crew member is missing and presumed dead. Officials are now very worried about environmental damage. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll hear about layoffs at the Department of Education. But first, a spending bill to avoid a government shutdown is headed to the Republican-controlled Senate for approval. It's a step toward avoiding a partial shutdown that would start Friday at midnight. The measure would keep the government funded through September. It passed the House with a vote of 217 to 213. One Republican voted against the bill, while one Democrat voted for it. So now Senate Democrats have to decide what they're going to do. We're going to put the question to Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. He is a Democrat who sits on the Senate Finance Committee, and he's with us now. Senator, good morning.
Good morning.
So in the House, as we said, they got the bill over the line with 2 votes to spare, but in the Senate, 60 votes are needed. Republican Rand Paul says he's a no, so that means the Republicans need as many as 8 Democrats to pass it. Before I ask you what you're going to do, can you lay out the arguments for and against? I mean, the pro, obviously, is to keep the government from shutting down. Republicans, starting with Trump, have made it clear they're going to blame the Democrats for shutting down the government if that happens. What are the arguments for voting against it?
Well, Michelle, President Trump and Elon Musk are already shutting down the government. For the time he's been president, now just over 50 days, they have torn through agency after agency. You're about to talk about the Department of Education, where half its workforce has been laid off. So a government shutdown is already underway, and it's being done piecemeal, without planning, without any kindness or decency to folks who've served veterans and help keep our nation safe and help run our Social Security agency. So first, the argument for not giving President Trump and Elon Musk more power to do more bad, to move money around at will, to shut down more organizations, and to give it our vote, our support, I think is clear. The argument in favor is that while this is bad, and while almost every Democrat in the House and almost every Democrat in the Senate opposes what Donald Trump and Elon Musk are doing, the risks of shutting the government down may be greater, because we don't know what this unusual president might do to further break the guardrails.
So
court after court that has reviewed his abrupt and cruel spending cuts has said they were illegal or unconstitutional. President Trump is coloring outside the lines, and so I respect those senators who have real concerns about what more Trump might do in the midst of a government shutdown.
Okay, so the bill largely actually preserves spending levels as they existed under President Biden. Does the opposition come from what's in the bill itself? And I do want to mention that the District of Columbia takes a big hit. It would cut $1 billion from the district budget for the rest of the year. All of the city's elected leaders say this would be a disaster. But is this more about what's in the bill, or is it all about taking a stand against the actions of the Trump administration more broadly?
It's both, because this is not what we call in the Senate a clean continuing resolution. It's a dirty continuing resolution. It doesn't have positive provisions that ensure that the president will follow the law or that ensure that there's a congressional role in oversight as the president uses this as a slush fund to move billions of dollars here and there. What a continuing resolution really means is that, yes, the funding levels are roughly similar to what they should have been last year, although with real cuts, as you mentioned, to the District of Columbia government, but to lots of domestic agencies. But it also gives the president more range to move money around the federal government, around the country at will. And we're already seeing him use that power to extract concessions. Look, the way that he is taking advantage of his tariff power to bluster and bludgeon and pick fights with our closest allies, which has sent the stock market tumbling, will be mirrored by how he will use this power, if this passes, to bluster and bludgeon against states and cities and programs that he dislikes
by
abruptly cutting off funding.
So given all that, what you've just laid out here, what are you going to do? Have you decided how you're going to vote?
I'm an appropriator. I am going to vote against this dirty continuing resolution because I don't want my vote to give an imprimatur to what President Trump is doing. We can and should find more efficient ways to spend federal government dollars, but the ways in which he is cutting veterans' mental health services, tens of thousands of employees out of critical agencies that keep us safe and support our country, and the rising threats in recent comments from Elon Musk and others close to Trump to go after Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare alarm me and will not have my support.
So if the Democrats, as we've just discussed, and as it's been made clear, the Speaker of the House has made clear, Mr. Trump has made clear that if the government does shut down, they're going to blame the Democrats. So, and you already laid out your objections to the bill, your argument that this just gives Mr. Trump even more license to abrogate both, you know, rule and law as you see it. How are you going to navigate that?
This seems pretty clear to me. From the day he started with his DOGE exercise, Elon Musk and Donald Trump have been slashing federal programs, laying off federal workers by the thousands, and doing it without any thought or eye towards efficiency and improving operations. My guest from Delaware to President Trump's speech last Tuesday night was a two-tour Marine combat veteran who was working in wildlife conservation and in the preservation of wetlands in Delaware for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, for their Rural Conservation Service. He got an abrupt, unjustified firing notice on Valentine's Day. Okay. He is one of thousands and thousands of federal workers across the country who've been fired abruptly. More importantly, or equally importantly, what they were doing has value to our community and our country.
Understood. Senator, if the government shuts down, and let me ask it this way, actually. It was an achievement for the Speaker to persuade most Republicans to vote for this bill, even though we know that many of them had objections to it. Do you think that the Democrats will be similarly united on this? Do you expect that all Democrats will vote against this bill as you have planned to? And if they don't, does this further signal that the Democrats don't have a coherent response to this administration?
No. Democrats in the Senate are going to fight for our appropriations bills that we've already done on a bipartisan basis that are ready for action. We're going to work to get a vote on the floor of a 30-day continuing resolution to keep the government open while we finish our appropriations bills. And Michelle, let's be clear. It's President Trump who is already shutting down the government, and it's Elon Musk who's been cheering on those who want to shut down the government.
That is Senator Chris Coons. He is a Democrat from Delaware. Senator Coons, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Last night, the Trump administration announced it's cutting nearly half of all staff at the U.S. Department of Education.
Shortly after, many of those employees started receiving emails letting them know they would soon be losing their jobs.
NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta has been hearing from some of those staffers. So let's just start with the scale of these layoffs and what parts of the agency were affected.
Yeah, so the announcement that came from the Department of Education Tuesday night said the agency was cutting nearly 50% of its staff, and that number includes some of the people who've already taken voluntary buyouts or decided to retire. And in that statement, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said these cuts reflect the department's, quote, commitment to efficiency, accountability, and ensuring that resources are directed where they matter most, to students, parents, and teachers. And the announcement clearly said all divisions of the agency will be impacted. The Department of Ed sent union leaders a list of employees who would be laid off, and the union shared that list with NPR. The cuts are certainly wide-ranging. Hundreds of employees from the Federal Student Aid Office, just under 250 employees from the Office of Civil Rights, and another 100-plus from the Institute of Education Sciences, which was already gutted by other federal cuts a few weeks ago, and many other parts of the agency were reflected in that list, too.
All right. Now, you've been in touch with some of the staffers who are being laid off. What have they been saying?
Yeah, I heard from multiple employees who were notified yesterday that they will be laid off in coming days. Sharia Smith is an attorney at the Department of Ed's Office for Civil Rights. She's also president of AFGE Local 252, which is a union that represents Ed Department employees. And Smith, along with all five of the other union officers in her chapter, were told Tuesday that they're being laid off.
Not only are we concerned about how we will now pay our bills, but what impact this is going to have to the American public, families who have students with special needs. What they've just done today is fire hundreds of the employees that would be enforcing those rights.
So the Office for Civil Rights, where Smith works, is responsible for making sure students aren't being discriminated against at school, and that includes students with disabilities.
Now, I know this news is pretty fresh, but do we know if these cuts are even legal? I mean, aren't some of these education department offices protected by law?
Yes, they are. So, for example, the Institute of Education Sciences, or IES, does research on all kinds of topics related to American education. It has a bunch of sub-branches that were established in laws passed by Congress as well. But I saw a termination email for an employee of one of those sub-branches that I'm talking about that clearly states that their entire unit is being, quote, abolished. Whether or not that's legal is not clear yet. Say, like, if the Ed Department has retained at least some of the employees at these offices that are protected by law, they could be leaving the door open to say that office hasn't completely been shut down. Kenneth Wong is a professor of education policy at Brown University, and here's what he said.
Now, the executive branch can argue that they are partially implementing the law, and they would probably argue that there's no longer a need for the personnel to fulfill these functions.
So Wong says that will ultimately be up to Congress and probably the courts to decide.
All right, that's NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Abe.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post national education writer Laura Meckler joins us to discuss how the administration's calls to dismantle the Department of Education could reshape America's education landscape, impacting schools, colleges, and universities nationwide. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. This chant will be returning to the grounds of the Capitol here in Washington, D.C. today.
What time is it?
It's time for courage.
Every Wednesday this month, more than 24 faith-based groups are holding vigils outside Congress. They want lawmakers to push back against Trump administration cuts and what they see as an erosion of democracy. The Christian social group Sojourners is organizing the vigils. They began last week with speeches from Amanda Tyler of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty and Darcy Hirsch with the National Council of Jewish Women.
We are here to remind members of Congress that they were elected to represent their constituents' interests and not to serve a king.
Our Jewish faith obligates us to pursue tzedek tzedek tirdof, or justice. Today, that work requires us to urge Congress to have courage, to be steadfast in the face of an existential threat to our democracy.
What time is it, Congress?
It's time for courage!
The voice you heard leading the chant at the end there is the voice of Sojourners President, the Reverend Adam Russell Taylor, who is with us now. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
To whom is this message directed? I mean, is it mainly Republicans who have overwhelmingly voted with the president, or is it to Democrats who seem confused about how to respond?
To be honest, I think it's directed at all of Congress. We need courage across the board. And it is true that the Republican-controlled Congress is controlled by Republicans. So I think there is a particular need to stoke the conscience of Republicans. But we also need more courage and more outspoken leadership from Democrats as well.
Would you say more about why you and the other people who are joining you in these vigils see this as a question of faith and morality as opposed to partisan politics?
Yeah, I think these are profoundly faith issues. In our faith traditions, there is an imperative to protect the most vulnerable. And we have seen an administration that has targeted and sometimes villainized and dehumanized people that are often at the margins. And more recently has tried to cut programs that benefit people that are living in poverty. But it's also a faith issue because we believe that protecting the core systems and norms of our democratic system is critical for how we as a country promote the common good and how we can realize many of our faith convictions to, again, protect the most vulnerable.
So how do you understand the fact that people who identify as Christian, especially white Christians, especially people who identify as evangelical, voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump?
I recognize that, and it's hard for me to reconcile their vote with a lot of the core Christian values and convictions that I glean from my faith and from scripture. That being said, I mean, I think we need to have an ongoing dialogue with Christians that view politics and view how to apply their faith to politics in a very, very different way. I will say, though, that there are a number of evangelicals, particularly more recent ones, that, you know, call themselves evangelical, but when you actually look at whether they're active in a church or if they even understand what that actually means, many of them don't. They've kind of declared themselves evangelical because they see it as synonymous with their support for Trump. It's become kind of a political label.
So before you let you go, I'm thinking about something that a person who worked for Catholic Charities told me once. I'm not helping you because you're Catholic. I'm helping you because I am. Is part of this witness a living out of your faith commitment?
Yeah, I mean, we feel it is our responsibility to really kind of be truth tellers in this moment. Today's vigil has a particular focus on the devastating cuts to foreign assistance, the freeze of aid and the dismantling of USAID. Back when this freeze was put in place by Elon Musk and Doge, Musk described our USAID program as being evil. I'm reminded of the prophet Isaiah, who said, "Woe to you who call evil good and good evil." We are literally seeing programs that do an incredible amount of good being declared evil. And so, yes, new administration has the prerogative to review programs, even to audit them. But what they're doing is wholesale differently than that. And in the case of foreign aid, they are literally trying to dismantle a program that literally saves lives.
That is the Reverend Adam Russell Taylor. He is the president of Sojourners. It's a group that's leading interfaith vigils at the Capitol every Wednesday through March. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
March is Women's History Month, so we asked NPR listeners about the inspirational women in their lives. Here's some of what they shared.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Moffitt. I live in Malaga, Spain. My hero is my mother, Rebecca. My mother was the bravest woman that I know. She survived cancer 3 times. And I'm just in awe looking back that we 3 kids grew up with confidence. We felt secure. And our lives just felt as uninterrupted as possible during that time. She died many years after the cancer, quite suddenly from sepsis. Her lessons and love are instilled in me, and they guide me as I raise my own sons.
My name is Trish Moiko Tobin, and I'm a journalist in St. Louis.
As a young journalist hired right out of college, I was thrown into the legendary but ever hectic newsroom at KMOX Radio. Joan, the station's senior editor and later news director, took me under her wing. Joan was one of the first women to lead a newsroom back in the day when newsrooms were largely male-dominated. Beyond our time in the newsroom together, Joan continued to mentor and nurture me through a very special friendship that lasted decades until her death last month.
Hi, my name is Kieran, and I'm from Virginia. My submission is my fiance. I will never truly be able to thank her enough for all that she does. She truly is an amazing woman, and I hope she knows and understands that she has great strength with her words and her kindness. I love looking into those eyes and seeing what love is. So happy Women's Month.
And happy Women's History Month from us too. This is NPR News.
The Trump administration has targeted parts of the government that could serve as a check on President Trump. For example, the firing of inspectors general across 18 federal agencies.
If one really were serious about limiting wasteful spending, the last people you'd get rid of were the inspectors general. That is precisely their jobs.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, a breakdown of Trump's attacks on the government. On the next, All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. inflation's showing improvement, but President Trump's tariffs are fueling concerns that could change. As of today, the U.S. is imposing 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports. The EU retaliated with levies targeting up to $28 billion of U.S. goods. The latest European leader to visit the White House is Irish Prime Minister Micheál Martin in observance of upcoming St. Patrick's Day celebrations. Departing from long-standing tradition, Ireland's main opposition party, Sinn Féin's boycotting over President Trump's handling of the war in Gaza. NPR's Lauren Frayer says a meeting also takes place against a backdrop of the trade wars.
President Trump has expressed anger at countries that have trade surpluses with the U.S., and Ireland has Europe's biggest one. It's also part of the European Union, which has imposed retaliatory tariffs on some U.S. goods. Trump has called for European allies to spend 5% of their GDP on defense. Ireland spends just 0.2%.
During a plane refueling stop in Ireland, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters the administration is hoping Moscow says yes to a ceasefire proposal Ukraine agreed to.
That's what we're hoping to hear from them. And obviously, as I said, that this was not prearranged for them. So they're probably processing the news the same as the rest of the world is. So we hope to have a positive answer from them. The ball is truly in their court.
Secretary Rubio en route to North America following talks in Saudi Arabia this week. From Washington, this is NPR. The U.S. Congress has until Friday night to pass a bill that averts a partial government shutdown. The House approved a stopgap spending plan yesterday. NPR's Clara Grisales says the Senate will now take it up.
It's a rarity to see Congress to fund the government this way for an entire year. Traditionally, we see them pass a full year appropriations plan, but bipartisan negotiations failed to come together in time, so Republicans turned to this partisan plan instead.
Pakistani security officials say forces have rescued scores of hostages from a train that was hijacked by armed separatist militants. NPR's Dee Hadid reports many more people are still being held.
Rebels seize control of the train as it passed through a tunnel. The rebels are from the Balochistan Liberation Army, which seeks independence from Pakistan. They're demanding the release of all Baloch political prisoners and those who have been the victims of enforced disappearances. Baloch young men suspected of loyalty to separatist groups have long been seized by Pakistani security forces. Pakistan often accuses neighbor and rival India of supporting the Baloch rebels. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Asagal.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 211 points, or roughly 0.5%, at 41,221. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Europe is retaliating against American tariffs on steel and aluminum. The EU said this morning it will have tariffs of its own April 1st. India is closely watching the trade war, especially as manufacturing gets more expensive for China. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
An advertisement shows a woman watching a cricket match on her Apple iPhone in a yellow and black auto rickshaw that bounces on jutted roads.
You really can't get more Indian than that. And in some ways, it reflects India's hopes of expanding Apple's presence here. Around 15% of all iPhones are assembled in India, and officials hope to double that within a few years. Apple started manufacturing here in 2017. It was big news.
Apple has started manufacturing its flagship device in India.
That move was largely seen as a way to loosen Apple's reliance on China, where most of the company's products are made.
It created opportunities for India to take advantage of that, to get some investment here.
Arvind Subramanian is a former economic advisor to the Indian government. He says Prime Minister Narendra Modi seized on the opportunity to encourage businesses to shift their manufacturing to China. Now, with Trump in power again, India hopes to profit by luring more manufacturing to its shores. One of those places is Subramanian's home state, Tamil Nadu.
Tamil Nadu has been better at exporting it than other states.
It's nestled in India's southern tip, has a distinct culture, language, music. It's India's manufacturing powerhouse. It makes cars, clothes, solar panels, sneakers for Nike, Puma, Adidas. Consider this. Nearly half of all Indian women who work in factories work in Tamil Nadu. So it's no surprise that the state has already benefited from businesses seeking to shift from China. And a lot of those businesses are around the industrial town of Sri Perumbudur, like Foxconn, which assembles Apple iPhones. It's a busy place. Music blares from the shops. Labour agencies dot the main road. On the stairwell of one agency, we meet Kirtana. She's only got one name. She is 21, thick braid over her shoulder, duffel bag at her feet. She came into town on the overnight bus to find work at Foxconn and got a job there right away through the employment agency.
That was very fast, huh?
Kirtana isn't sure what job she'll do at Foxconn, but she'll make $170 a month, double what she was making at a clothes factory. Subramanian, the former economic advisor, says while those wages are low in the West, it's life-changing for women like Kirtana. And for that,
I am unambiguously in favor of manufacturing because you get many, many more women, especially getting jobs.
But there's a key obstacle to Tamil Nadu and to India attracting more manufacturing from China.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
In early March, Trump imposed more tariffs on products coming in from China. That was expected, but has also singled out India for its high tariffs. And in his State of the Union address, Trump vowed that on the 2nd of April,
reciprocal tariffs kick in.
Reciprocal tariffs against India. The announcement came despite a last-minute dash by India's trade minister to Washington to try negotiate carve-outs. Because if those tariffs come into force, they'll be a blow to India's hopes of attracting more manufacturing. And it will make it more expensive to export goods to the US, which is India's biggest market, at a time when the Indian economy is flagging and needs a hand up, not a punch down. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Sri Perumbudur.
After 9 hours of talks in Saudi Arabia, Ukrainian and American delegations announced an agreement on a 30-day ceasefire last night.
This comes less than 2 weeks after a string of harsh words by President Trump directed at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky culminated in an Oval Office blow-up between the two and the impression that the new administration was taking Russia's side. Now, though, the pressure is on Russia to accept the American-Ukrainian deal.
We go now to NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, who is in Kyiv. So, Eleanor, 30 days. What does that buy Ukraine?
Well, A, that buys them peace, space, and calm to begin real talks about a long-term peace. It would include the cessation of all shooting, bombs, missiles, drones on the Black Sea, the front line, and in Ukraine's cities, of course. And the Trump administration announced it is resuming the sharing of intelligence and delivery of military supplies, which it had temporarily paused. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the ball is now in Russia's court.
Ukraine is ready to stop shooting and start talking.
And now it'll be up to them to say yes or no. I hope they're going to say yes. And if they do, then I think we've made great progress. If they say no, then we'll unfortunately know what the impediment is to peace here.
So that's an incredible statement, Aide, less than 2 weeks after the Trump administration seemed to blame Ukraine for not wanting peace.
Yeah. Now, how are Ukrainians reacting to this?
Well, President Volodymyr Zelensky took to social media immediately to herald the agreement. Here he is speaking.
Американська сторона розуміє наші аргументи.
He said, the American side understands our arguments, accepts our proposals, and I want to thank President Trump for the constructive conversation between our teams. So again, a complete turnaround for Zelensky from that disastrous Oval Office meeting. I arrived in Kyiv last night just as the news of the deal and the renewed intel sharing was breaking, and I spoke to 35-year-old Dima Suhak. Here he is.
I think that's great. We need this information for sure.
And how did you feel when it was stopped?
I feel disgusted.
Less safe.
I don't know if you heard his friend, but she said they felt less safe because satellite intelligence not only helped on the battlefield, but it helped Ukraine defend its cities by giving advance warning of high-speed Russian missiles. And having lay in bed last night on my first night in Kyiv to air raid sirens and then the explosions of drones being shot down over the city, I can tell you it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, that meeting in Saudi Arabia was between Ukraine and the U.S. Now what?
Now the U.S. delegation is set to meet with the Russians. There's been no official reaction from Moscow yet. I spoke with Samuel Sharap, who is a Russia specialist at the think tank the RAND Corporation, and he says, surprisingly, there is common ground between the Russians and Ukrainians.
What Russia, interestingly, has in common with the Ukrainian position, again, is that they, too, want to ensure that this isn't a temporary pause, that whatever agreement they reach actually ends the war in a way that they're not facing a renewed, you know, Ukrainian attempt to retake Ukraine's territory in the future.
He says no one has won this war and both sides will have to compromise.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Kyiv. Eleanor, thank you.
You're welcome, A.
This is NPR News.
Look at what government powers exist to deport people, even permanent lawful residents, and how those powers came to be under President George W. Bush. Next time, Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. In a country where shooting sports are big, so is a commitment to follow the letter of the law. We're talking about Switzerland, where a local town councilman recently paid about $7,300 for violating the country's weapons law. He'd bought pink water pistols for his godchildren as a gift. Prosecutors said they could be confused for the real thing, and he needed a permit. He said he didn't know he was in the wrong, but he accepted it, and he paid the fine. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
On a Wednesday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Life after retirement can be isolating for a lot of people, particularly older men. But it turns out that making a difference to someone else's life can give older guys a big boost. Here's Ashley Milne-Tite.
When Jim Eisenberg of White Plains, New York, first became a grandfather, he wanted to meet other men at the same stage of life and do things together. So he went online,
trying to find any kind of organization with grandpas. There were a lot of things with grandmas, which we always say, God love grandmas.
But nothing for grandfathers. Ultimately, Jim and his friend Frank Williams founded their own group. They called it Grandpas United. Jim and Frank wanted to bring retired men together socially and give them a continued sense of purpose. Here's Frank.
A lot of guys don't play golf. What do you do? You can give back. You can serve.
Frank works as head of the White Plains Youth Bureau, and he saw a particular need.
So many children are growing up without a male figure or a father. And then here we have men who are retiring from work and careers.
So he and Jim started popping up at local farmers markets and recruiting older men to join them as mentors. Grandpas United works with boys and young men. Today, several grandpas gather at a White Plains elementary school. They hang out with fourth grade boys here every couple of weeks.
All right, are we ready to play chess here?
John Stewart, okay, a former IT guy, is playing with David, who's nine. We're not using David's full name because of his age. John explains the roles of bishop, knight, and queen.
She can do anything except for the knight's move.
So you can, like, protect her?
Yes.
Programs like this have real benefits, says Dr. Linda Freed. Today, she's dean of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. A few decades ago, she was a practicing geriatrician and noticed a recurring pattern.
They started having patient after patient for whom the reasons they were truly sick were that they had no reason to get up in the morning.
They felt they had no value in society. That galvanized her to start Experience Corps. A study on the outcomes showed striking results.
Men who were volunteers demonstrated over a two-year period an astounding increase in the size of their brain.
In the regions associated with problem solving and memory. Why? Freed says it may be that because older men socialize less than women to begin with, the consistent volunteer work and seeing they were making a difference did them the most good. Sociology professor Dawn Carr of Florida State University says knowing their community has needs they could fill could appeal to a lot of older men.
Who otherwise might feel more comfortable in the safety of their house watching television throughout the day alone, which is actually the activity that older men engage in more than anything else.
Anne Carr says there's another upside to volunteering.
You're able to do something where you feel like you have meaning and purpose, but you're doing it alongside other people who have a similar shared purpose.
Grandpas United member Mark Scharf knows this firsthand.
One of the things that I love about grandpas is not only with the kids, it's the camaraderie and building new friendships, and I cherish that.
He feels great satisfaction helping boys and young men while staying connected with older ones. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The FAA is permanently banning most helicopter flights near the Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said Tuesday he was accepting recommendations from the National Transportation Safety Board. This comes after the January crash between an Army Black Hawk helicopter and an American Airlines jet that killed 67 people. Duffy also said the FAA is going to use artificial intelligence to sift through data to try and avoid future disasters.
We're going to make sure we've learned from this air disaster, and we're going to pay it forward so there's not other families that have to go through the pain and anguish of losing a loved one like these families had to go through.
The NTSB is still investigating the crash. David Shaver has more on these early findings.
In releasing a preliminary report on the tragic January 29th mid-air collision, NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy says investigators found that there have been at least 85 incidents in which helicopters got dangerously close to commercial jetliners landing at Reagan National Airport in the last three-plus years. Homendy says the flight route the Black Hawk helicopter was on over the Potomac is of particular concern when planes are approaching to land on the runway the American Airlines regional jet was heading towards.
We've determined that the existing separation distances between helicopter traffic operating on Route 4 and aircraft landing on runway 33 are insufficient and pose an intolerable risk to aviation safety by increasing the chances of a mid-air collision at DCA.
Homendy says at that spot, aircraft can be separated by as little as just 75 feet.
That is far too close of a proximity. We have stated it's an intolerable risk to aviation safety.
Homendy says it makes her angry to know that there have been scores of prior near collisions in this crowded airspace over the years and that calls for changes have been ignored.
It does make me angry. But it also makes me feel incredibly devastated for families that are grieving because they lost loved ones. It shouldn't take a tragedy like this to occur.
In a statement, some family members of those who died in the crash say the NTSB's report reinforces what they suspected, that what they call serious systemic failures in air travel safety cost their loved ones their lives and continue to threaten public safety. The NTSB report did not disclose any new clues as to what may have caused the deadly mid-air collision, but the investigation continues. For NPR News, I'm David Shaper.
Greenland's center-right party is a winner in its parliamentary elections. Now it needs to build a government. One of the biggest political topics there is President Trump's comments about the island. He said he wants the U.S. to take control of the territory one way or the other. With us to talk about the results is reporter Adrian Murray, who's been following along from Copenhagen. So, Adrian, how did the center-right party pull off this upset?
Well, winning the most votes and delivering the biggest surprise of the election is the moderate centre-right party, the Democrats. Until now, they've been a small player in Parliament, but the party took around 30% of the vote. The Democrats, they favour a slower, more gradual approach to independence from Denmark, which technically controls the island of 56,000 people, even though Greenland has had a self-governing agreement since the late 1970s. The party has put building up the economy first before severing ties. Greenland's economy is driven by fishing, and it still relies on annual subsidies from Denmark. It's also been a strong election night for Nalarak, the Greenlandic party seeking the fastest breakup with Denmark and deeper defence ties with Washington. And that seals what's been a really bruising night for the current coalition government.
Now, how much of what Donald Trump has said about Greenland maybe affected this election?
Well, one newspaper editor said the independence debate has been put on steroids by Trump. It's understood Greenland has caught Trump's eye because of its strategic location and mineral resources. Since taking office again in January, Trump has repeated again and again his intention to acquire the territory. And even though Greenland and Denmark's leaders have said that Greenland is not for sale. Now, that's perhaps indirectly helped amplify some of those pro-independence voices. But earlier polls also showed that 85% of Greenlanders do not want to join the United States. This continued rhetoric from Trump, I'm told, has begun to scare some people who have begun to worry that becoming independent so quickly might also make the country more vulnerable.
So what is the results and everything we've talked about? What does that tell us about Greenland's future?
Well, this election has been seen as one of the most pivotal for the Arctic Territory's future. Five of the six parties on the ballot had favoured breaking away from Denmark, but offered different paths and speeds. Earlier polls have shown that around 80% of Greenlanders back moves towards future statehood. And overall, in this election, most votes have gone to parties that want to take more gradual steps. Though the Democrats have won the most votes, they're still short of the seats needed for a majority in Parliament and will now enter talks with the other parties to form a new government.
And speaking of Denmark, where does this leave them?
Well, never has an election in Greenland been so closely followed in Denmark. And it comes amid intense geopolitical pressure from the United States. Denmark's Prime Minister has said Greenland's future is to be decided, though, by the Greenlandic people. Meanwhile, a string of revelations about past mistreatment of Inuit people has damaged relations between Greenland and Denmark. And I think there'll be now a big collective sigh of relief that most Greenlanders haven't voted for a swift divorce. Experts suggest, though, that the process could take several years and that Greenland is unlikely to see independence before Donald Trump's second term comes to an end.
All right, that's Adrian Murray in Copenhagen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.